Let me begin just by saying thank you to you for a really wonderful weekend. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself here. Of course, this is the second time I've been to the area in a couple of months, and that was the first time after about 30 years. So I hope it's not another 30 years before I get to come back here. I'll be 90 years old then. You'll have to wheel me in. But thank you very much, and thanks too for your hospitality to my friend Harry, who was greatly encouraged. He really was encouraged by being here with you today, this weekend, and I thank you for that. It was great to see him. We were quite a team when we worked together, and I've not known anyone who has been as great a helper to me in the ministry than Harry was when we were working together. It was great to see him again. Well, this morning we began by talking a little bit about the differences between the Reformation in England and the Reformations on the continent, and we began then to talk about the great King Henry VIII. And we mentioned some of the simple facts of his life, and we began to get into the complexities of his reign. And you remember we ended this morning by talking about the legitimacy of Tudor family rule and succession, because his father had come to the throne by seizing power on the battlefield and basically by killing all of the other rivals to the throne. And so Henry VIII held a tenuous position upon the throne of England. But there's another complicating factor that we need to keep in mind as we move forward to think about the strange way that God brings about the Reformation in England. And that is the problem of Henry's place on the throne himself. Henry's place on the throne himself. You see, Henry was the second son of Henry VII, not the first son. Back in those days, the first son of the king inherited the kingship, and the second son, or the third son, or the fourth son was put somewhere else. Henry had an older brother whose name was Arthur, born in 1486. England almost did have an historical King Arthur. But Henry VII, the father, had two sons, and he seems to have designated his sons one for the throne and one for the church. So Arthur was prepared, schooled, everything was ready for him to take the throne at the right time. And Henry, it seems, was intended for the church. Now, of course, back in those days, the royal children would not have attended any kind of school or university. They would have been schooled at home with tutors. Henry probably had religious tutors during his youth to bring him up. And it's thought that Henry VII, the father, intended Henry, the man who became Henry VIII, intended him to take the position of Archbishop of Canterbury, which is, as we said this morning, the highest ecclesiastical office in England. Now think about that. Henry VII has two sons. One of them is destined for the throne, the highest political office. The other is destined for the Archbishopric of Canterbury, which would be the highest ecclesiastical office. You see his designs for a Tudor dynasty in state and in church. Henry, as we'll see in a few moments, this helps to explain why Henry could write a treatise against Martin Luther, because he seems to have had theological training while he was a young man. Now, Arthur had been engaged to marry Catherine of Aragon in 1488. Arthur was 2 years old, and Catherine was 3 years old. Have you engaged any of your children here yet to a Spanish princess? Not yet. Okay, yeah. She was the youngest daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. Now, when I say Ferdinand and Isabella, who do you think of? Christopher Columbus, right. That's the family. She was their youngest. And this was a royal match between the House of Tudor and the House of Ferdinand and Isabella, made for specific political purposes. One of the things you have to understand is that England was at this point, when this engagement takes place in 1488, England is a backwater country. It's not a power in Europe. Spain is the power in Europe. France has more power than England. Whatever is going on in Savoy or in Italy is more powerful. England is on the fringes and is unimportant. So Henry VII, desiring political power and legitimization for his rule, works out this deal in which he's able to engage his son to the youngest daughter of the household of Ferdinand and Isabella. Now, remember what we said before, when they have a lot of children, you have to find something to do with the young one. So the youngest one, you can send off to a less important country. But to Henry VII, that makes England a very important country, because now his son is engaged to marry a child of one of the great houses of Europe. The prestige of Spain is thus brought into the English royal house. They're engaged in 1488. The marriage actually took place in November of 1501. So that's 13 years later. Arthur was 15 and Catherine was 16. Now this marriage included the traditional, what was called the bedding ceremony, in which the newly married couple is accompanied to the bridal chamber by the guests and put to bed together. They're brought up there and they're put in the room. That's in November of 1501. About 6 months later, April 1502, Arthur dies suddenly. He had probably what was the sweating sickness. You remember in Wolf Hall, Cromwell's two daughters die of the sweating sickness? It's a really strange sickness. Scholars today don't know exactly what it was, because it seems to have died out early in the 17th century. We don't have reports of it after that. But it was some kind of virus or some kind of sickness that suddenly came upon a person. They would have terrible sweats and convulsions, and many times they would die. And that's what happened to Arthur. He had been married for less than 6 months. After waiting a suitable period of time to ensure that Catherine was not pregnant, Henry, who had been intended for the church, was now made Prince of Wales, the heir to the throne, because he's the next in line. And so he becomes the heir apparent and the Prince of Wales. Now, we have to think back to the father again. The father's still alive. Okay, why did he have Arthur engaged to Catherine? Because he wanted the prestige of the royal house. But now all of a sudden Arthur is dead. But you still need the prestige of the Spanish royal house. So what did he do? Well, basically he put Catherine under house arrest and wouldn't let her leave England. She's his daughter-in-law now. She is related to him, at least by marriage. He keeps her under his watchful eye, ensuring that she would remain. And so he sets then in motion the process to cause her to be wed to the Prince of Wales, who is his second son, Henry. All right, so you get the picture. You have this royal princess who's been engaged to and then married to the first son. After 6 months of marriage, the first son dies. The father keeps the girl in England and then sets in motion the process by which she can marry the second son, Henry. She's 6 years older than he is at this point. Now, since she had been married to Henry's brother, Arthur, it was necessary, even though he was dead, to obtain papal permission for this marriage to his brother. It's actually called a dispensation. You know, there are our confession talks about, when it speaks of marriage, it speaks about degrees of consanguinity and affinity. It's one of those words that you look at in the confession and you say, what is that about? Well, degrees of affinity are degrees of relation by marriage, and degrees of consanguinity are degrees of relation by blood. And Christians have always believed that there are certain relations, either by blood or by marriage, that cause an individual to be out of bounds as an appropriate marriage partner. Okay, that's what that's all about. And a brother marrying his brother, his dead brother's wife, was considered to be out of bounds by the Roman Catholic Church. So it was necessary in this case to receive from the Pope a dispensation in order for Henry to be able to marry Catherine. So Dad's still in the background pulling the strings, you see. He wants the prestige of the royal family, and he arranges for this dispensation, which is granted by Pope Julius II. Now, because of some mostly political reasons, the marriage didn't take place until 4 days before Henry VIII's coronation in 1509. Remember, he's just about 18 years old. His father dies. He comes to the throne. They're married only 4 days before. Now, there's something that's important to say right at this point. Whether or not it's true, it's very difficult to know. It's impossible for us to know. But in the aftermath of what happens, Catherine always consistently claimed that her marriage with Arthur had never been consummated. So that when she was married to Henry, she was still a virgin queen. That was her claim always. And of course, in her mind, that legitimated the marriage. She had never actually been the physical wife of Arthur, and so she was able to be the physical wife of Henry. Now, what happens then, if we can pull this together, is that Henry comes to the throne just about at the age of 18 and with a new bride. And the stage is set. Now, at this point, Henry has received a dispensation from the Pope. All seems to be well. He wants to demonstrate his allegiance to the papacy. Maybe this is payback for what the Pope did by granting the dispensation. We don't know. But in 1521, he publishes his treatise, A Defense of the Seven Sacraments. And it was a direct attack on Luther, and it was praised by the Pope. Now, because there's good reason to believe that Henry had been trained up to serve in the church as Archbishop of Canterbury, there's every reason to think that Henry himself actually did write this book. That is, that it wasn't written by someone else, but Henry's name was slapped on it for him to get the credit. In fact, as the story unfolds, Henry gives evidence of some knowledge of theology and scripture. And that plays a part in everything that happens from this point out. So there's every reason to believe that Henry had some understanding of the Bible and of theology. And of course, as we said this morning, not only did the Pope praise the book, but the Pope actually granted to him the title Defender of the Faith. That title still belongs to the monarchs of England. Although Charles, who, if he lives long enough, someday might be king of England. Who knows, maybe Elizabeth will live forever. Charles is already an old man, if he comes to the throne. He has said that he wants to be known not as defender of the faith, but as defender of faith. Notice the difference? That's the coexist type thing that we were talking about yesterday. That's what Charles wants. By the way, England has never had a good King Charles, but that's just an editorial comment. At this point in 1521, Henry VIII is a faithful and orthodox Roman Catholic. And there's no reason to think otherwise at any other early point. He's just another Roman Catholic king in a European country. But soon, things begin to change. And they begin to change around the year 1525. And the reason that they begin to change is that Henry needs a male heir. He needs a legitimate son who will be able to take the throne when he dies and carry on the Tudor dynasty, these grand plans of his father, Henry VII. Catherine of Aragon only gave Henry one surviving child, and that was Mary, who was her fifth child. They actually had six children. Five of them died. Mary was the sixth child. Of course, she was a girl. The first baby was a girl. Then there were three boys, including one boy that lived for 52 days. And there was another girl, a sixth child, who lived only briefly after birth. So, three boys, three girls. Henry desperately wanted a male heir to ensure the succession of the Tudor dynasty, and as time passed, he grew increasingly impatient. Now, you know what? We know a lot more about genetics and reproduction today than they did in the Middle Ages. And let's face it, 1525 is the Middle Ages. It's the end. Sometimes we call it the early modern period, but it's really the end of the Middle Ages. And one of the realities of medieval belief is that they ignorantly placed a great deal of responsibility upon the woman as the one who bore the child and had the responsibility somehow for determining the gender of the child. Now, we know that that's not true today. We know that that's not the case. But that's what they thought. They didn't understand genetics. They would often blame the mother for a stillbirth, that somehow she had sinned, or that she had done something wrong during the pregnancy. And so Henry, with his pomp, with his pride, with his arrogance, reflecting medieval, barbaric medical views, it begins to blame Catherine for the fact that there's no son that survives, even into toddlerhood, never mind adolescence, or into adulthood. And Henry, probably as a result of his theological education in the past, begins to muse about the things that are happening. Now, you know, there's a sense in which you can't blame a man for beginning to wonder about something like this, especially a king. And at this point, I want to give Henry a little bit of credit. Now, you heard me say this morning, he's a tyrant. He is a tyrant, okay? I'm not trying to whitewash this guy. But what I'm trying to say is, I think that in his mind there were some competing factors that were at war with each other. And one of them is his religious training. Henry seems to have had some legitimate doubts about the validity of his marriage to Catherine based upon a couple of texts of Scripture in the Old Testament. Leviticus 18:16. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. Leviticus 20:21. If a man takes his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. And then the law of Moses says, they shall be childless. They shall be childless. Now, this was a crucial text, and it seems to have deeply affected Henry because it provided him with an explanation for the problems that he and his wife were facing. Now, technically, of course, it's not true because they've got a daughter who's growing up named Mary. But he interprets childless to mean no son, no heir. Ladies, you know, be thankful that you live in a day and age where your personhood is recognized far more than it would have been in 1525. I love my wife and I love my daughters, and I thank God that we don't live in 1525. Now, Henry, as we said, had theological training. And in some things, he seems to have taken religion seriously. Not many of them, but in some things. In fact, as the story unfolds, over the years, he expresses concern about the propriety of his marriage based on these things. He was very concerned about idolatry. He wanted to remove from places of worship various images and icons that had been placed there because he was opposed to idolatry. Is that a good thing? Of course it is. Likewise, he objected to the doctrine of purgatory. Didn't believe that purgatory was something that Christians ought to believe. That is also a good thing. So you see, there is some evidence that Henry was a man with some religious sensitivities. And as he read these texts of Scripture and mused on them and thought about his life and thought about the death of his three sons, all of these things came together to contribute. This is not the only reason, but probably came together to contribute to the fact that he believed there was something wrong with his marriage. Now, there's another side to the picture. The other side to the picture is that Henry was, remember those words from this morning, rough and rough, vainglorious and arrogant? Henry it is depicted to us, there's no reason to doubt this depiction, as a man brimming over with self-confidence, and who seems to have believed that he was attractive to every woman in the realm. And there's no doubt that he had a wandering eye and that he acted upon his wandering eye. We know that he had several mistresses. There was a woman named Elizabeth Blunt. She was the mother of his illegitimate son named Henry Fitzroy. Fitzroy means the son of the king. But, and actually, one part of the discussions at one point was, could they legitimize Henry Fitzroy to take the crown after Henry VIII would die? And it was concluded there was no way that they could do that. There was no way that this man who was, this boy who was his son, no one questioned that Henry Fitzroy was the son of Henry VIII. But he was the son of a mistress and not of a wife. And so he could not come to the throne. Likewise, there's strong evidence to believe that Henry actually had a mistress in Mary Boleyn, who's Anne Boleyn's sister. There's also some other names that have been suggested along the way. The reality is that Henry was a man with a wandering eye, and because of the power that he had, he was able to bring these women to himself and use them. Now that has to play a part in this story as well, because at this point, Catherine has had six children. Catherine is 6 years older than he is, and Henry is looking at the young girls in his court, and he's attracted to them. Okay, you get the picture. It's not a very pretty picture. In fact, it's a horrible picture. It's a picture of gross immorality on the part of a king who thinks he can do whatever he pleases in his realm. Into the midst of this, into the mix, while Henry is struggling with all of these things, desperately hoping for a son, along comes a young and attractive lady at court who catches his eye, and that's Anne Boleyn, the sister of Mary, the younger sister of Mary. Now, someone asked me the question this morning about her character, because there is a debate in all of the literature, the scholarly studies about Henry and about Anne. The question is, was she a devout woman, or was she simply a young girl who saw her chance at power and so used her youth and beauty as a means to attract the king? That's an important question, isn't it, about a person's character? Now, if you were to read the literature currently, the scholarly treatments of the life of Anne Boleyn, it's interesting that most of them today are leaning towards the fact that she was a devout woman rather than a power-hungry woman. We'll see how she's portrayed in the Wolf Hall series. Like I said this morning, I've only seen two of them, so she hasn't really appeared on the scene yet. It'll be interesting to see how they portray her. But based upon the state of the literature, I tend to agree that there is evidence that she was a devout woman. Certainly she had some contact with Thomas Cromwell, and we said this morning he seems to have had access to some Lutheran books and some English translations of the Bible. Well, Henry sets his eyes upon Anne Boleyn, and he begins the process of reaching out to her, hoping that he can make her his mistress. But she refuses all of his advances. She will not give in to the king. Now, there are some possibilities to this. If she was a devout woman, if there was any form of genuine Christianity in her, then her moral scruples would have prevented her from succumbing to the advances of the king, right? That's what a Christian woman would do, would say, no, that's wrong. That's a violation of the seventh commandment. I won't do that. Others look at her character and her actions at this point and say, well, you know, she was power hungry. And she knew that she was the apple of the king's eye. And so she could use her denials of the king's advances to achieve her goal. Because it is said that she told him that she would only give herself to him if she were the Queen of England. So in a sense, if that's the case, then really what she's doing is tempting him, you see. You make me the queen, and then we can have a marriage relationship. But otherwise, I'm just a prize that's just outside of your reach, Henry. Just outside. Come and get me. So we don't know. It's very difficult to say what's going on in the mind of Anne Boleyn, what's happening with her. But there she is. She comes to court right in the middle of all of these circumstances. And Henry is deeply troubled. And he tries to find a solution. And the solution that he comes to, the conclusion that he arrives at, is that he wants to end his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. And he wants to take a new wife. And of course, that new wife at this point probably will be Anne Boleyn. Now, there's something that we have to realize, a little technicality of language here. You remember the rhyme from this morning? Divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. It's inaccurate in one sense, in that there was no such thing as divorce. It had to be an annulment, see. And a divorce is not the same as an annulment. A divorce is ending a legal marriage. But an annulment says there never was a legal marriage. And so the person is free to marry again. Divorce was virtually unknown in the Roman Catholic Church. And there was no hope of remarriage after a divorce. But you could remarry if your previous marriage was annulled. Because in the eyes of the church, that said you never were married anyways. You're still a single person. Go ahead and marry someone else. So technically, Henry is seeking an annulment of the dispensation that was made by the Pope that allowed him to marry his brother's wife. Is it complicated? Yeah, I mean, this is a soap opera, if ever there was a soap opera. And let me tell you the end of the story. The Reformation comes. That's the weirdest part of it all. All of this. Thank you for reading that text, brother, because it makes sense of this. God, I said before, Henry VII is behind the scenes pulling the strings, but it's really God who's pulling all of this together for the strangest conclusion that the Reformation comes. Well, back to the story. It's not a divorce, it's an annulment. Now, who was it that approved the marriage in the first place? The Pope, right? So guess what you have to do? You have to go back to the Pope this time, and you have to gain papal approval, another dispensation from the Pope. And when the dispensation would arrive, when the Pope gave permission, then Henry would marry an unencumbered and suitable young woman in order to produce an heir. That was his plan. I'll send my envoys off to Rome. They'll achieve for me this goal. The marriage with Catherine will be annulled, and I'll be able to obtain another. We talked about Thomas Cardinal Wolsey this morning. Wolsey was unable to bring this to pass, and that's why he got in trouble with Henry. Henry actually sought advice from the leading theologians of the realm, including the faculties of Oxford and Cambridge universities, just to make his case. And he sends off his envoys to Rome, expecting that soon they will come back. The first dispensation was quickly granted. His expectation is, this will happen fairly quickly. I'm the king of England. How could they turn me down? This will happen. And so he sends off someone to Rome. Well, what happened? Well, Rome delayed. You think it's complicated already? Now it gets worse. The Pope that had granted Henry the dispensation to marry Catherine was Julius. He was long dead. And so was Leo X. And so was Adrian VI. So it's three popes later. Now it's Clement VII who is the Pope of Rome. And he's unwilling to grant the request of Henry. Now, at this point, it's really interesting what goes on. If you read Roman Catholic apologists who want to address this issue, they will say for the Pope it was a matter of theological scruple and principle, and because of his theological scruple and principle, he wouldn't grant the annulment to Henry VIII. Well, then I would say not. Almost certainly not. That's a nice excuse, but that's not the way it goes. Okay? This is what happened. Catherine, remember who she was? She was the youngest daughter of the house of Ferdinand and Isabella, the most powerful monarchs of Spain, maybe the most powerful monarchy in Europe at the time. Okay? Though she was the youngest of the Spanish royal house, she still was one of their heirs. Now, at this time, 1525 or so, Charles V was the Holy Roman Emperor. Okay? In a sense, he's the real big dog over everybody. You know, we talked about the counties and the duchies and the principalities and the kingdoms. Well, you had the Holy Roman Empire, which, you know the joke, right? The Holy Roman Empire wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it wasn't an empire. But that's what they called it. It was mostly the Germanic states. Charles V was the Holy Roman Emperor. Guess who he was? He was Catherine's nephew. All right? Henry VIII's wife, Catherine of Aragon, is the auntie of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. And in 1527, Charles and his army invaded Rome and took control. Okay? Now, we're talking politics and religion here. But when Charles V goes into Rome and takes control with his army, who's in Rome who suddenly is subject to Charles V? The Pope. Charles V has the Pope under his thumb because he's now the ruling power in Rome. And he's the nephew of Catherine of Aragon. Now, imagine you're the Pope and you've got Henry far away, the continent of Europe plus the English Channel, and he's off there on this island asking you for a dispensation. He's at a long distance, right? But you look out the window and what do you see? You see the armies of Charles V, and you know that he can walk through the door at any time and say, hey, Pope, do this. Who are you going to satisfy? The answer is pretty easy, isn't it? The Pope knew that he was in trouble, and there was no way that he could grant this dispensation to Henry, because he would offend the guy who could do away with him at any moment in his own city. That's why I say, the Roman Catholic argument might sound nice, but it's highly improbable given the political circumstances of the day. And these popes were not men who were godly men. Let's be honest about that, all right? Now, so you have Rome delaying. You have Henry sending envoys trying to find some way to convince the Pope to grant this annulment, and the Pope refusing. So the envoys come back one after another, saying the Pope will not give in. Henry hopes for a quick solution. It doesn't come. Now, there are several factors that are involved in this. First, there is theological opposition. Several of Henry's most important aides disagreed with his policy. These were men with religious scruples. Two of them deserve to be named. John Fisher. Fisher was probably the leading Roman Catholic theologian in England. Henry needed him to support his argument because he's trying to convince the Pope theologically that this is the right thing to do. So he needs the prestige at this point of the most important theologians in England. Fisher refused to give in to Henry. Guess what happened to Fisher? It's not very hard to figure out. You know what happened? He was deprived of his office, he was put in prison, and in 1535, off with his head. He's executed. He's dead. Remember what we said this morning? You don't oppose Henry VIII. Sir Thomas More. Thomas More was, from all appearances, beloved by Henry. After Wolsey died, Thomas More becomes his chancellor. He's the man who wrote the book Utopia. He was a devout Romanist, and Henry wanted his support above all things. But More refused to grant it to Henry. Guess what happened to Thomas More in the same year as Fisher? Off with his head. He kills him. If ever there was a despot or a tyrant, it was Henry VIII. Men that he loved and respected, because at this point, they could not support him. And Thomas More, what's interesting about him, he didn't oppose the king. He would never publicly oppose the king. But he couldn't support the king. And that cost him his life. He was in perhaps the highest political office apart from the king in England at the time, Lord Chancellor, and he lost his head. There's more that's going on in the background in England. There's political opposition. Many faithful Roman Catholics in England supported Catherine because they believed that she was an aggrieved woman. They didn't think that it was her fault that five of the children had died, the three boys and two of the girls, and that Mary was the only surviving child. This was not her fault. And whatever Henry does, it's a result of his lustful desires for another young woman. And so many of the people of England view Catherine as an aggrieved woman. Others are coming to recognize that those in the court, in the circle of power around the king, are one by one falling away from him. He's executing them, and they viewed him as a tyrant. Remember what we said this morning about the fall in the jousting tournament and the way that it seems to change Henry's personality? Well, people with some wisdom are looking at the circumstances and they're saying, this is really bad, and this is the king's fault. And so there's a growing groundswell of opposition to Henry's action on the part of much of the population. You know, remember we said this morning, one of the differences between the Reformations in the city-states of Europe was that they were driven by theologians. You could say in some ways that those Reformations were a bottom-up kind of Reformation. Many of the common people or the priests in the parishes adopted the Reformation, and the protectors, the city council or someone like Frederick the Wise, came to watch over them and protect them. But it was a bottom-up type of Reformation. That's not what happened in England. It was a top-down, because in many ways, the population were still Roman Catholic and supported the Roman Catholic Church. This matter drags on for years. And for the sake of simplicity, let's state that Henry, increasingly frustrated by the resistance of Rome, seeks after alternatives. In the end, he sacks his closest aides, kills many of them, and he found men more willing to do his bidding. Most notable among them are Thomas Cromwell. We mentioned him this morning. And if you're wondering, you know the name Oliver Cromwell, right? Distant relations. Thomas Cromwell is about 100 years before Oliver Cromwell. So they would not even have known each other. But it is the same family, but distant relations. Don't confuse the two, though. Oliver Cromwell was a different person. Thomas Cromwell, Thomas Cranmer. Cranmer, interestingly enough, we said this morning that in many ways he was the reformer of England. You know how he came to court? He was the family chaplain for Anne Boleyn's family. Most of the wealthy families of England had their own chaplain, their own priest who would live in their home and say mass for them on a daily basis. Thomas Cranmer came to prominence because of his relationship with the Boleyn family. Cromwell handles the political factors, and I suspect that that's what you're going to see if you watch this series, Wolf Hall. You'll see how Cromwell takes care of the enemies of Henry and does everything that he can to bring about the annulment. But Cranmer begins the process of theological argumentation, and as a result, Henry takes the fatal step of breaking with Rome. And in 1534, Henry declares himself to be the supreme head on earth of the Church of England. That was his claim. I am the supreme head on earth of the Church of England. And by taking this action, he pushes the Pope out of the country, at least politically. Now, of course, well, maybe I'll say that later. This is the doctrine of royal supremacy. And Henry begins this process. And it's really important to understand it as the Reformation moves forward and as it sort of transitions into Puritanism. The controversies, the battles that were fought between the Puritans and the throne were largely as a result of the doctrine of royal supremacy. The king, you see, up to this point, had a view of his power in the land that said everything political is subject to me. I am the final authority politically. And what Henry did was look at the church, and he said, the church is in my land, and since I have authority over everything political in the land, I will also have authority over everything religious in the land, in my land. He doesn't claim supremacy over church in Switzerland or in France. He claims supremacy over the church in England because that's where his rule is. So he takes the principle of royal supremacy and he extends it to the church. So now the king has absolute power politically and religiously in the land. Thomas Cranmer is really an interesting character, and he deserves a lot more credit than he gets. This is what I think is going on with Cranmer. In the early days, he's a Roman Catholic who seeks to carry out his responsibilities as a Roman Catholic priest. But in trying to do Henry's will and finding support for an annulment or a divorce, when the Roman Catholic theologians in England won't help, Cranmer begins to consult with the Protestant theologians on the continent. And I think that through his consultations on the continent, Cranmer becomes a true believer and then more and more understands what the Reformed doctrines are and helps to lead forward the Reformation in England. See, I think that Cranmer is actually converted while he has this position of power and learns what the doctrines of the scriptures are all about, so that by the time you get to the end of Cranmer's life, he has much more knowledge of what the Reformation and the Reformed doctrines are about than when you first see him appear at the court of Henry VIII. It's a developmental process for Cranmer. That's the opposite of Luther or Calvin, isn't it? These guys know what they believe and then seek to bring those truths to others. Cranmer develops, and that's why, in one sense, he doesn't really fit as the reformer of England, though he is the most important of those who would be called reformers at the end. In 1531, he went to Basel, and he sought help for the cause of Reformation. He sought approval for the divorce from Reformed cities. He sought their help. Zurich becomes one of the most important cities for the English Reformation. There's actually two huge volumes of letters that are sent back and forth between Cranmer and others with him and the leaders of the Reformation in Zurich in Switzerland, trying to give counsel to what happens in England. Cranmer, interestingly enough, at one point actually gets involved in a secret marriage. If you were a priest of the Roman Church and you were married, you would be subject to the death penalty. And on one of his trips to the continent, Cranmer actually marries the niece of one of the Lutheran reformers, Andreas Osiander. He has to bring her back to England and hide her for a long time because he can't let anyone know that he's been married. That's another sign that the Reformation or the Reformation doctrines are taking root in Cranmer's life when he goes ahead and does this. Well, the end result of all of this is the Reformation in England. Now, we need to understand this very carefully, okay? The Reformation in England was emphatically not, at this point, a theological reformation. It wasn't. It was a political separation of the Church of England from the papacy, and it was an assertion of the doctrine of royal supremacy, and that is the key doctrine to understand. Henry claimed for himself the right to have final say over every aspect of the life of the Church within his realm. And so basically what Henry did was replace the Pope with the monarch. And this replacement serves as the basis of royal action for Henry, for Mary, his daughter, for Elizabeth, for James I, for Charles I. And there were only two factors that in any way mitigated Henry's step to put himself over to replace the Pope with the monarch. Only two things happened. Number one was Mary. Mary's return to Rome. And number two was the Civil War 100 years later, when Parliament said, no, you will not be the absolute ruler in this land, either in church or in state. All the rest. Elizabeth, what happens to the Reformation under Elizabeth? It's a halfway house. It's called the Middle Way. It's not really Roman Catholic. It's not really Protestant. It's somewhere in between. And that's because Elizabeth wanted to assert her rights of power over the church. When Elizabeth dies childless, and James I comes to the throne, he had been James VI of Scotland, he was her cousin, he was the closest relative who could come to the throne, he came down from Scotland, the Puritans in the Church of England thought, aha, now we have an ally. Here's a king who's been trained in Scotland, Presbyterian Scotland, Reformed Scotland. And James comes down and he meets with the Puritans at Hampton Court Palace, that palace I told you about this morning, very famous conference called the Hampton Court Conference. And they approach him. The representatives of the Puritan movement have about 1,000 signatures from clergymen in England. This is 1603. And they ask James to complete the Reformation in England, to do away with the Episcopalian system, to bring in Presbyterianism, to remove from the worship of God the idolatry that characterized the Church of England. And James said no. In fact, James said, no bishop, no king. If there's no bishop, there's no king. James knew that the Episcopalian system of the Church of England was the perfect means to control the whole country. Think about it like this. No phone, no smartphones, no internet, no means of communication, except that everybody theoretically in the country came to church every Sunday. If you want to reach the most distant parish in the country, you can do it in about 2 weeks by writing up a decree, handing it over to the bishops, asking them to copy it, and then send it out to all of the parishes in the land. And James knew that that was the means by which he could control the entire nation. So when the Puritans come to him and they say, we'd like you to dismantle the system of bishops and put in its place a Presbyterian system, he says, no bishop, no king. Take away the bishop, you take away my ability to rule in my realm. The only good thing that came out of the Hampton Court Conference was the King James Bible. That's why we have it. 1611, right, is when it was published. James agreed that he would allow a new Bible to be published. You know why? Because he didn't like the Geneva Bible. He didn't like the Reformed things that were in the Geneva Bible, and he knew that he could control the religious life of the nation with the King James Bible, or what we call the King James Bible. That's an interesting little part of the whole King James only question. Let's go back to Henry. Let's rewind by about 80 years. Henry based his doctrine on an extension of his political view of divine right. As king, he claimed absolute political right in his realm. It was something of a logical extension of this principle to apply this to the church also within his realm. It was an innovation, but it makes sense. Henry had an exalted view of himself, and it really was medieval. Now, let me ask you a question. Let's say that you lived in 1534. And today, you're a Roman Catholic. And tomorrow, you hear a decree that the king says, the Pope is gone, I'm now head of the church, this is the Church of England. Does that change your religious status at all, your convictions? Not a bit, right? If you're a priest, you're a priest yesterday, you're a priest tomorrow, just because the king makes a pronouncement, your theological views are not suddenly changed. So Henry still had a problem. He still had a problem because the Roman Catholic Church was very powerful, especially up in the north. Most of the great landowners, the wealthy barons of the north of England, were faithful Roman Catholics. And Henry knew that he had to do something. I'll finish with this story. There's a couple more that we could tell, but this is one of the most interesting. And this, when Henry drives out the Pope and claims that he's the head of the church, there's a massive religious movement present in England that's not subject to Henry, that's still Roman Catholic. You know what it was? It was the monasteries and the convents. The monasteries and the convents answered directly to Rome, not to the Archbishop of Canterbury, not to the Archbishop of York. They had their own relationship to Rome. And so in many ways, Henry could not suddenly claim that he was the head of all of the monastic orders in Rome. I'm sorry, in England. But he knew that he had to do something about them. They were funded by the wealthy landowners. They were very, very rich. They were very powerful. They owned huge pieces of land in many places around the country. They were the center of religious activity. And there were about 900 of these scattered throughout England. So Henry decided he had to do something about this remnant, very powerful remnant of papal submission. So what did he do? Well, there's another factor that needs to be considered. By the 1530s, Henry had spent all of the money that his father had left to him. Remember we said this morning, his father was a successful businessman, if you can call a king a businessman. But he knew how to make money, and he knew how to save money, and he had stored it up. But by this time, Henry had spent it all. But he looks around and he sees monasteries that have allegiance to Rome and that are full of treasures. So our friend Henry, this nice, friendly king who always does what is good, sets in motion a plan to capture the wealth of the monasteries. What he did was he chose a couple of men under Cromwell's leadership to do what was called a visitation. And the visitation was exactly that, a visit where they would go and take inventory of everything in the monastery, in the convent. How many men? How many women? How many buildings? How many cattle? How many sheep? How much land? What kind of treasures? What kind of silver plate, gold plate? What kind of jewels? What do you have? And they would take record of everything. And then they began with the smaller of these houses. And they would find a reason to say, we're going to revoke your charter. Maybe there weren't enough monks. Maybe there weren't enough nuns. Maybe the place had a reputation for allowing some kind of heresy or strange doctrine or even immorality. That's one of the charges that was frequently made against the monasteries. And once they could make a case against one of these houses, Henry would send in his men. They would drive out the priests or the nuns. Now, generally, at least they did this. They provided them with a pension. They gave them some money. And if they were ordained monks, they would put them into a church to serve. You know, it's interesting that in the Middle Ages, most of the monks were not priests. They were laymen. The monasteries were places for laymen who didn't want to be ordained but who wanted to live a religious life would go. But there were priests. You had to have a priest to celebrate the Mass. So sometimes they would take the priests and put them into a parish. Sometimes they would give them a pension. They didn't drive them out into poverty, but they took everything that they had. They would go into these places. They started with the smaller houses. Then they went to the big houses. They would go into them. They would take literally everything. Then they would go to all of the buildings. Now these buildings, some of these big church buildings in the monasteries, would have had a wooden roof covered with lead. Largely, the roofs on the big churches were made of lead. They would go up there, they would strip the lead off the roof, and then they would take all of the wooden beams down from the roof. They'd dig a pit next to the church building. They would set fire to the wood, and they would melt down the lead, and they would make shot from it. So now you have a building with no roof, open to the elements. Then they would take out all of the windows and all of the doors, so all that you had left was the stone of the building, just an empty shell. And I love to go to these big old monasteries when I'm in England. I find them absolutely fascinating to walk around, to sit in the chapter house. The chapter house would be the place where the monks would do their business. And there's always stone seats all the way around a square room. And you could sit there and you can picture these monks with their tonsured haircuts talking about the business of the monastery. I can see it when I'm sitting there in that place. They would have taken away everything. And when you drive to these monasteries today, look around at the homes nearby. You know what you see? You see the stones that were taken out of the monastic buildings used to build homes in the area. People would go and they would scavenge anything that was left behind by Henry's men. Between 1530 and 1540, all 900 monasteries and convents in England were gone. Every single one of them. That was the last remnant of religious power that the Roman Catholic Church had in England. Now, it didn't change the priest necessarily, and it didn't change the hearts of the wealthy landowners who were committed to the Roman Catholic doctrines, but it essentially what it did was it stripped Rome of its wealth and its power by first taking over the church and then by removing all of the abbeys, convents, monasteries, everything. Now, you know, Henry was clever in some ways too, because you take out all of the treasures and you strip the buildings of everything that you can use, but you still have a huge plot of land. So you know what you do? You sell the land to the wealthy gentry, to the landowners, as a bribe. So now they won't rise up against you, because to do that would effectively be to take away the land that they have bought from Henry. So he was a pretty shrewd character here. And you know what? When you look at it, this from one side, it's a money grab. That's what it is. It's a money grab. It's an attempt to line his pockets and to do away with the threat of religious influence from the monasteries. But if you look at it from a Christian perspective, Henry took away everything that was against the spread of the gospel in England. That's the strange thing about this. All of these, the most powerful presence of Rome, the monasteries, the nunneries, the abbeys, are all gone by 1540. And that's about the time that you begin to see Puritanism develop and the Reformation move forward. Well, there's just a whole lot more that we could say about this. Time has run away. Henry dies. His son Edward comes to the throne as a teenager. Everything that we know about Edward, he seems to have been a godly young man. I've never seen anybody question Edward's character. He really does seem to have been committed to the Reformation, and it moved forward, but within 5 or 6 years, he died. He was 15 years old when he died. And now he was the youngest of Henry's surviving legitimate children. He was the son of Jane Seymour. Now there's only two sisters who survive, Mary and Elizabeth. And Mary comes to the throne. Mary is a dedicated Roman Catholic. Mary is the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. We're going back to the Spanish house now, okay? And Mary believes that her mother was a wronged woman. So Mary has a grudge against the Reformation, because she sees the Reformation as contributing to the sad course of events that led to her mother's demise. The marriage is annulled. They send Catherine off to a monastery, basically a nunnery, to live the rest of her life with some women around her, but she's isolated and she dies. And Mary takes up a grudge, and so she sets out the process of restoring the Church of England to its former Roman Catholic glory, and begins the process of martyrdom. Many Protestants flee the country. They go off to the Reformed cities in Europe, and it's an interesting providence of God there too, because now they're going to cities where the Reformation has developed, and they're seeing it firsthand. And Mary reigns for about 5 years, and she dies of ovarian cancer. And then Elizabeth is the last surviving child of Henry VIII. She comes to the throne, and most of the Protestants are able to return and bring with them the things that they have seen overseas. Here's one of the ironies. Henry VII wanted to establish a dynasty of the Tudors. Henry VIII wants to see that dynasty continue, and he has three children. His three children come to the throne, but none of them have children. And when Elizabeth dies, the Tudor dynasty dies with her. And now it's the Stuarts who come down from Scotland. Well, I've been talking for an hour, and that's enough. Do we have time for some questions if anybody wants to ask questions? It's a fascinating story, isn't it? Really.
We have a little bit of time. When we were looking through our Protestant Revolt series here, they made a great deal about the Marian refugees.
Okay.
Basically, burn everybody in sight. trying to bring back the church. These guys don't sleep in Geneva.
That's right.
And they don't get into Calvin school, and they don't really get grounded. And then, of course, when she's gone, they come back.
Mm-hmm.
You see how the wrath of man works to praise the glory of God.
Yeah.
All over the place.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a really good illustration of that principle, isn't it? And that God uses, through many tribulations, we enter the kingdom of God. And these guys went through a lot of tribulations. But really, in many ways, we're the result of that. You see, as the Reformation develops in England, it turns into Puritanism, which leads to the development of the Baptist movement, which comes to America, and here we are. You know, in many ways, this is the beginning of our story right here. And, you know, you can't say in the providence of God, we wouldn't be here today without this. No, I'm not going to say that. But this is how it all came to pass. That makes it fascinating. Yes?
Henry used Leviticus as a reason he wasn't sure he could marry. Yet in the Old Testament, if a man died without children, brother was supposed to marry.
Yeah, the law of levirate marriage. Yeah.
When did it change?
Well, that's a good question. You'd have to ask Henry that question, you see. But they knew that you know, there are competing stories in the Old Testament. And it's not, that's a specific situation where the brother dies childless and you marry the woman simply to raise up a child in the name of the dead brother. That's what the idea is. What Henry's case was not the same as that. And that's why they put the law of levirate marriage to the side and concentrated more on these other passages from Leviticus. That's a great question. Yeah. And it's good that you thought of that.
But they weren't just proof texting to find an angle.
Yeah. Yeah, let's be honest about it. Yeah, yeah, that's what they were doing. Because, you know, everything about life is religious at that point. There is no such thing as a division between the secular and the sacred. Everything is religious. And so you have to have some kind of religious justification for virtually everything that you do. They also lived in a world that was very, in a strange way, it was very conscious of the supernatural. They were superstitious about a lot of things. Even if you go to Boston, maybe even here, I don't know if you have 17th century graveyards in the area here in Virginia. Okay, you may have some. I know in Boston in the graveyards, if you go to the old graveyards, you look at the tombstones and there'll be some kind of spooky creature, angel carved on the top. Even on Puritan headstones, because they had this superstitious view of death and what happened at death. So. It was a strange world. Yeah. I wish that we could keep going and talk about the development of Puritanism. Can I take 1 minute? And let me give you an example of what I think was a brilliant action, but it seems strange to us today. The Book of Common Prayer, okay, that has a really interesting origination. A lot of Christians today look at the Book of Common Prayer and they say, oh, that's just Romanism. But the Book of Common Prayer was written because of this problem. There were about 10,000 parishes in the Church of England. Okay, imagine that, 10,000 in the island. And today you're a Roman Catholic and tomorrow you're not. Does that change your convictions? No, it doesn't. Well, during the reign Edward, as Edward is promoting the Protestant Reformation, they realize that they need to do something to spread the gospel in the churches. And how do you do that? Do you suddenly remove all of the priests from 10,000 parishes? Who do you put in there? There's no one to put in there. You might have 100 or 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 men who are committed to the doctrines of the Reformation, but what's 500 against 10,000 parishes? What can you do? So they came up with this idea of putting together the Book of Common Prayer, which would have readings from Scripture and then what were called homilies. They were effectively sermons. And they were the priests, these men were told that they had to read these things from the pulpit week by week. So now you have a structured worship so that theoretically every parish in the nation on every Sunday is hearing the same things, and what they're hearing is the gospel. Martin Bucer is invited during the reign of Edward to come and teach at Cambridge University. He becomes Regius Professor of Divinity at Cambridge. That's the top position at Cambridge. Peter Martyr Vermeili is invited to take the same position at Oxford. The two great universities, you have two great reformers. And Bucer is asked to look at the Book of Common Prayer and evaluate it. You see, you have reformed men who are writing these things, and then the king is imposing them on the church. Now, in that kind of a situation, it seems to me like a pretty good solution. The problem is that it turned idolatrous after a few years, after a couple of decades, and the Puritans began to hate the Book of Common Prayer, especially when Elizabeth said, we don't need sermons, we have homilies. Puritans wanted preaching. Elizabeth said, we don't need it. All we need is the homilies in the Book of Common Prayer. And the Puritans said, we can do a lot better than that. But I think in that circumstance, the Book of Common Prayer was actually a brilliant idea, because it did provide for the people in the parishes so long as the local priests followed the order of the king and read those words. So, you know, all kinds of fascinating stuff that's going on here. In many ways it was, yeah. Yeah, but it was more than that, though. It was the only means that they could devise to ensure that the truth went out to people every week. But it certainly was catechetical, yeah. Yeah, good question. It's very difficult to determine literacy rates. One way that it's been done, and this has been objected to, is people have examined wills or wedding documents or birth certificates, and if someone could write their name, they're counted as a literate person. But then it's pointed out that anybody can learn to make the figures of their name. That doesn't mean that they could write. But the figures are maybe 50% of the men and less of the women. And that would, if you're in a city, more likely that you'd be literate. If you're out in the country, less likely, but very low literacy rates.
So then using the Book of Common Prayer teaches people the gospel.
Yeah.
Without them being able to read and understand.
Right, because it comes from the pulpit. See, it's focusing on the literate, the ministers, who are able to at least read that to the people in some way. And I think it is a good method under those circumstances. Yeah, because you don't have 10,000 men that you can suddenly send out. Oh, that we had 10,000. Oh, for 10,000 men to preach the gospel to our land. We could sing that.
Cranmer, the primary author of the Book of Common Prayer?
Cranmer is definitely behind it. I don't know if we can say that he's the primary author. He's definitely behind it. All right. Well, thank you very much. As I said, I've had a delightful weekend with you, and thank you for your kindness and your hospitality and your Christian friendship.